You are listening to Radio Free Signs of the Times, broadcasting into the heart of an occupied America.
Fox News, objective, to the point. News that you can use
while you snooze. Welcome to this week's Signs of the Times podcast. This week, for a change, it's just myself, Joe,
Henry,
and Scott.
The old school crew. And we're going to be discussing various subjects that have cropped up in the news of late. So sit back, grab a smoke. If you don't smoke, start. Have a coffee.
Wine.
We're back with more obscure references, dodgy analysis, and wild speculation. The kind of stuff that you all love. To feed your paranoia and push you over the edge. It's all a conspiracy, as you know. Or you think it is.
Unfortunately, it is a conspiracy.
So,
I mean, take Doug Thompson, please.
Take him away. No, the Doug Thompson thing is very interesting because Doug is just one more of what has become a growing list of alleged 9/11 slash kind of alternative news pundits who has recently done a kind of about face, has decided that
he never was supporting these nebulous and completely unverifiable conspiracy theories. That I know of, he was very anti-Bush, but he was never in the Bush did it camp or the idea that 9/11 was an inside job.
Well, the people just assumed that he was because of his kind of outspoken,
because of his sharp analysis in other areas. One would
police
expect.
State and growing fascism, etc. But
because, folks, if you don't understand, I mean, if you can see what's happening in the U.S., if you can see the loss of freedoms, if you can see the growing police state, and you still can't make the connection about 9/11, there's a serious problem.
Yes. As we were just commenting earlier on today among ourselves, it's really not believable for anyone like Doug Thompson, who has shown a capability to, you know, critically analyze events, political events, and world events, and then somehow try to claim that he doesn't or he can't grasp the idea that, you know, the government, the U.S. government or any government would engage in any kind of a conspiracy or any kind of an attack on its own people or on itself like 9/11. I mean, not only does it tie in very well with Doug Thompson, for example, his analysis of the nature of government, I mean, that ties in very, very quickly and very easily with the idea that a government would, you know, carry out an attack, a false flag attack on its own people to pursue or to further some political aim. But there's also a long line of events, factual events from history that have shown that the governments all around the world have engaged in this kind of deceitful kind of political maneuverings and agendas, which include attacking themselves and blaming some phony enemy. So, I mean, as we were saying, it's people like that essentially almost automatically, maybe they can be given some leeway, but very quickly they have to be written off as essentially either, you know, in the pay of someone or having an ulterior motive or an agenda.
Well, certainly they are incapable of seeing reality as it is without those emotional filters that come in, that come from that basic idea that is so deeply rooted in many Americans that, oh, well, my president wouldn't do that or my government wouldn't do that. But we know from history that they do and they have repeatedly. They lie, they kill, they do what they need to maintain their power and to accumulate more and more.
Exactly.
There was another liberal blogger, Tom Engelhart, who, again, somebody who can write with great insight into what's going on, but again, somebody who doesn't buy into any of the so-called conspiracy theories about 9/11. I mean, we come back to the fact that the government's official story is a conspiracy theory, a conspiracy that some guy in a cave halfway around the world organized this with a handful of crazy Muslim fanatics who infiltrated in the United States and somehow got the entire North American defense system to stand down that day. That's a pretty good conspiracy. But nobody denounces the government for having a conspiracy theory. Tom Englehart wrote a piece recently, and he was talking about 9/11, and he was talking about how this small group of people had been able to, for him it was Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, had been able to carry this thing off. And it was amazing that this small group of people had been able to carry this tremendous attack off. And he said that it was so successful that it even surprised Sheikh Mohammed when he was arrested, that he said to his captors that he was really, really, really surprised. Now, the fact that all these people would be surprised because they had nothing to do with it doesn't enter in, but you've got these people saying it, and it's telling you, and bin Laden did not take credit for it. The only videotape that he apparently supposedly took credit for it is an obvious forgery.
And came years after 9/11.
Well, there was a tape that was found in Afghanistan as well. Conveniently, it had been left behind in a supposed safe house.
Yeah, it was a Fox News reporter tracked across Afghanistan for 14 hours in a car to this safe.
A true hero.
He was led across Afghanistan by someone, and he just stumbled upon this shack in the middle of nowhere, and he entered this mud hut, and lo and behold, what did he find? A smoking gun. It just defies belief, like Henry was saying, and like Tom Englehart said.
I think it is divine.
Well, it could have been the same God that led George Bush or told George Bush to invade Iraq that led him to it. But in fact, it probably was. But we'll not get into that right now. But the it really does defy, these kind of things defy belief. And as Tom Englehart says, it's just incredible that Al-Qaeda could have pulled off 9/11. But no one seems to take that one step further and say, well, if it's so incredible, maybe it's
because
not true. Maybe they didn't do it. Maybe it's completely impossible that they did it. But it's also that, it's not just Tom Englehart or people like him who say this. Tom Englehart may have an agenda or may not, but there are millions of people around the world who, ordinary citizens who also believe that Al-Qaeda were able to pull off 9/11. And it's that fact in itself is evidence for just how far people are from their own government, and from it's evidence for the complete and utter lack of awareness and understanding among people of how their government and their military functions. Because if people knew exactly how all of that worked, And all of the complete kind of control that the American government and the American military and the American corporate entities have over everything that happens within America and in other countries around the world, they would immediately laugh at the idea that a bunch of guys in a cave in Afghanistan could have overcome such a massive infrastructure. But they don't. They don't know. They think that their government is a very simplistic kind of, ordinary kind of organization that can be hoodwinked and be have one put over on it in this way.
One thing that comes to mind in what you're saying is 40 years ago, Che Guevara was in the jungles of Bolivia leading a ragtag band of supposed revolutionaries. And the United States was able to pin him down at that point because of his use of telephones, And that was 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we were recently talking with Jean-Pierre Petit about the development of technology and what we're being told about the development of fighters and that, and I suggest people go back and listen to those. But to think that in 40 years, the technology, the surveillance technology of satellites and the like, wouldn't be able to pin down Osama bin Laden in whatever cave he's hanging in, it's just preposterous.
Uh-huh. It's certainly that, but what the big secret, I suppose, that is kept from people, which allows this simplistic belief, such as that Al-Qaeda carry out 9/11, that allows beliefs like that to be perpetuated in the minds of ordinary people, is the fact that for centuries, forever maybe, leaders, political leaders, and their militaries that build up around them, and the business corporations that build up around them, all get into their positions of power essentially by deceit of one form or another. So the fact is, these people, the people that have been attacked supposedly, or the institutions or the infrastructure or the organizations that were attacked on 9/11, for example, the American government, the American military, these people are the grand deceivers. These are the people who spend their whole lives and are born into the idea of deceiving other people. So there's very little chance that anybody's going to deceive them, because essentially that's, you know, I mean, it's like they're not so innocent
at heart that they think that everybody around them is acting in good faith. And
certainly not, and they're able to spot a coup attempt, for example, or any kind of a plot against them. They're able to spot these things very quickly and very easily, and there's just very little chance for any kind of, you know, grassroots organization such as, you know, Al-Qaeda, that is fighting for some ideal, to put one over or to get the better of major governments or major institutions. That just doesn't
happen.
Especially
when they're funded by them and founded by them and supported by them.
Well, definitely, yeah. But even when they're not, as in the case of many kind of insurgencies, if you want to call them that, that have occurred around the world, as soon as those kind of things, if those kinds of insurgencies or grassroots kind of rebellions or revolts spring up, if they haven't been actually orchestrated by the powers that be, the people in government themselves, they're very quickly co-opted, because essentially it's like sheep and wolves, really. I mean, there's no way that a sheep is going to outfox, no pun intended, a wolf, because that's just not in their nature. And I mean, for example, the various kind of freedom struggles that have gone on around the world over the past century, there's evidence of this. When such movements spring up, they are right from the very beginning, or very soon after the beginning, that they're infiltrated or they're co-opted, or they're, because to a certain extent, it's in the interest of the political organizations and politicians or military personnel or military leaders to have this kind of a situation where you have someone to fight against, someone fighting against you, and you can therefore fight against them, because that can very quickly be turned to your advantage. So
sure, it justifies increased budgets and spending and all the toys of war.
Yeah, it keeps the population distracted as well when there's some kind of a conflict within their society.
Well, you mentioned earlier about the American people and the situation that as long as they can continue going on with the lives that they have, that they aren't going to wake up. And I think you came across an interesting article today about the situation in the United States. And it was an article about the fact that somebody who's earning a minimum wage, which would give them about $10,500
a year, and working full-time 40 hours a week on a minimum wage would earn in the U.S. about $10,500 a year. And that amount of money is not enough for that person to afford to pay the rent on a one-bedroom apartment anywhere in the U.S. And there are millions of people on minimum wage, and that's the stark reality, that they not only can they not afford to feed themselves, they can't even afford, if all their money would have to go on rent, and that wouldn't be enough, and they would have nothing left to feed themselves. So this is why, as other people have told us, so many people in the U.S. on minimum wage or little above it are having to work, you know, many more hours than the standard 40 a week, or having to work two jobs or three jobs, and it reminds us of the. I think Bush was at a few years ago, some kind of a gathering or a conference or one of these stage managed kind of questions and answers sessions in a town hall somewhere in America. And Bush was talking about the economy, etc. And a woman stood up and said, well, you know, I just wanted to say that, you know, I think I contribute, you know, I do my share because I work three jobs. Because I've got kids and I have to feed them, and I've got a rent and mortgage to pay, and I have to work three jobs to pay that. And I mean, this was, I don't think this woman was actually, you know, she wasn't, it wasn't a criticism, But in fact,
I think she was a Republican shill who had been put up.
Well,
because obviously the people that are in there have all been pre-screened.
But I think it backfired because it was immediately obvious. It was a very searing indictment of Bush and his administration and his economic policies, because you know here you had a woman who had to work three different jobs, just to keep her head above water, as you say. And Bush's response was just, you know, it just highlighted what kind of a person he is, where he said, you know, isn't that great? You know, that's fabulous. You know, and then he quipped, "Do you get any sleep?" You know, as a joke, asked this woman, "Did you get any sleep?" And she responded, "No, actually, I don't really get much sleep because I have to work three jobs, probably like you know, long hours." And I mean, that is the state of the American economy, but it's also the state of the American, for some people anyway, of the American mindset. Now, we don't know how many people who find themselves in such kind of financial hardship are still kind of, you know, true patriotic Americans, and who I mean, are we to believe that the millions of people in that situation hold no resentment against their government or the policies that the Bush administration has enacted that have caused this kind of a massive gap between the haves and the have-nots? For example,
we know the polls say that Bush's policies are massively disapproved by 60% or more of the American population.
Well, that doesn't seem to do any damage whatsoever to the Bush administration. In the wonderful democracy that you have there, you have 60%+ of the people who disapprove of the government. And
he's able to get his judges on the Supreme Court. He's able to get whatever law he wants passed through Congress.
And keep going, yeah.
And keep going.
Which, you know, just getting back to the point about the kind of financial hardship that many Americans are in. There's a report today from a major mainstream newspaper that gives some figures about the salaries afforded to the various kind of groups of the workers in America. And just to cite again, this person on a minimum wage working 40 hours a week earns $10,500 a year. Compare that to last year, the CEO of ExxonMobil, the oil company. He earned $13,700 per hour, compared to $10,500 per year for the low-paid worker. That's something like 2,000 plus times the wage. There's not much comment you can make on that, but
it's anecdotal evidence of the fact, as you said, this divide between the haves and the have-nots is increasing. That the polarization of the society is becoming more and more extreme.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, that will have to snap.
Mm-hmm.
The links between the top and the bottom are going to have to be broken. And what happens then, we don't know.
I mean, it's quite possible.
But it's going to be ugly.
Yeah, it's quite possible that this, you know, it has the gap between these the rich and the rich and powerful and the ordinary citizen has grown so much, but the effect of that obviously is, from the point of view of maintaining power and control, from the government maintaining power and control, is that, you know, when people have to work all their waking hours just to kind of to keep their heads above water, that doesn't leave much time for, you know, critical thinking or, you know, campaigning against your government or any kind of dissent, you know. So it's very useful from that point of view, and we have to wonder if at some point, feel free to break in anytime, Scotty. We have to wonder if at some point even the middle classes in America are going to suffer a similar fate if there is ever a major kind of economic collapse in the U.S.
Yeah.
Because then everybody, other than the rich and powerful, are in the same boat,
mm-hmm.
and at that point, there's who knows what happens, you know.
Yeah.
And regarding the divide between the haves and the have-nots, it's kind of curious because we had an article on the page recently that described how the number of jobs available in the U.S., the number of new jobs being created is up, but the small print of it is that the jobs being created are primarily incredibly low-wage jobs or incredibly high-paying jobs. So basically, if you have like a PhD in biochemistry, for example, you know, or you want to be the CEO of a company, well, you're fine. Or if you want to, you know, mop floors and make minimum wage and not be able to afford a one-bedroom apartment anywhere in the U.S., well, then you're also okay. But as for the middle class, which is the majority of Americans, well, you know, they're basically screwed. And the strange thing about it is that this division between the haves and the have-nots is actually being used by the Bush administration because they're saying, well, you know, look, we're, you know, jobs are up, we're creating jobs. And they're using this to justify the fact that or to justify their opinion, shall we call it, that the economy is going strong and that there's nothing wrong. And meanwhile, the middle class is kind of looking around at each other going, what the heck's going on? And then they're, you know, the polls are being taken and there's vast disapproval and yet nothing changes.
And the atomization of society is so complete that somebody can be thinking, oh, well, the newspapers say the economy's doing great, so if I'm having troubles, it must just be me, while the person living next to them and the person living across the street is doing the same thing, and it's being replicated in neighborhood after neighborhood across the country. But everyone is there thinking, well, if the newspapers say things are going well, it must just be me.
Yeah, and the other day there was all the news I think it was Yahoo News. It was, you know, a Reuters collection of articles, I think. All the headlines were how all these corporations are making these, you know, incredible, you know, they all reported their quarterly results and they were all up. And so, of course, this was like the great news because, you know, the economy's rebounding. And then there were two little articles hidden in there, one of them talking about the consumer price index indicating that things are becoming more expensive, which is obviously a problem if, you know, you're not getting a raise at work and your budget is already stretched to its limits. And the other was about interest rates on homes and how mortgage rates, which are now at the highest level since I think it was July of 2002. And of course, you know, there's all this talk, oh, you know, the housing bubble, it's not real, you know, everything's fine.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, that point about that perception that's disseminated via the media, you know, of profits for major companies being up because, you know, your ordinary you know, minimum wage earner or you know, person who's just struggling to make ends meet, you know, hears that and thinks, well, you know, my country's, you know, the economy is doing good, that, and I'm in the economy, so, you know, I'm doing good. You know what I mean?
And if I can just tough it out a little longer, it's going to trickle down to me.
Well, I don't even know if it's that. It's like it's almost like this cognitive dissonance between the fact that, you know, yeah, you're being told it's true that, you know, certain section of your economy is doing quite well, i.e. the guys who are making 2,000 times as much as you are. But the fact is you're still struggling to put food on the table, you know, or food on your families. As George Bush has said. But, you know, and it's just interesting to kind of speculate as to how long that can be, how far that can be stretched, you know, or how much longer, you know, this economic well-being or the perception of economic well-being can actually continue to feed people or make them feel like they're in a wealthy country when the stark reality is that they're not. They're working three jobs to feed themselves and to put a roof over their heads, you know. And it's like we've said in the past, you know, that, you know, we've often kind of thought that, you know, we talk about the media and the control that the mainstream media exerts over the population of any country, really, in the West particularly, but anywhere in the world, and how much knowledge and awareness and information those people have. And we tended to blame this fact of the control of the media on the apparent lack of, you know, of outcry or of uproar from the masses of humanity about all the crimes that are being committed on the planet at the minute. But it seems that even when people who are relatively well off or who are doing okay or able to maintain their normal lives, even when those people are confronted with the reality of what's going on the planet and that things aren't really that rosy at all and they're getting a lot worse, they just tend to switch off. They're not interested. And it's you know, it's a bit of a conundrum and a dilemma, particularly for us who are looking for people who can, you know, join with us or support us in what we're doing and lend their energy or their at least their support, you know, because we would like to see a lot more people, you know, reacting in the same way with the same revulsion to the, for example, the stuff that's going on in Iraq and in Afghanistan and in Palestine, to react with the same revulsion that we do, but. They give it cursory attention or cursory notice, but then it's back to normal life. And sadly, it seems, talking about the economy, that it seems that it'll only be at the stage where it affects such people directly, or that something, you know, their lives are changed, their normal lives are no longer tenable, that they will sit up and take notice. But even then, we can't expect them to take notice of the things that they should be taking notice of, because they'll be too distracted with trying to get their normal lives back on track.
Mm-hmm. Trying to survive. And you mentioned earlier that the people who are in power know about manipulations and they're able to see it. And they know that when things are pushed to the limit, that the people, the ordinary people, are going to get mad. They're going to get angry. They're going to see that they've been hoodwinked and sold a bill of lies. But as foresighted as they are making arrangements for that. Mm-hmm. And Dave McGowan, who's got a website called the Center for an Informed America, wrote an excellent article recently that was called It Can't Happen Here. And in there he's talking about, and he cites a press release that was given out by Halliburton, where essentially Halliburton has been given a 5-year, $385 million contract to establish temporary detention and processing capabilities, which, taken out of bureaucrat speak, mean camps, detention camps. And McGowan says, leading up to it, he says, none of the outrages committed by this administration, either individually or collectively, have awakened you from your slumber, and here he's addressing the American people, so I seriously doubt there's anything that I could reveal here that would provide the necessary wake-up call. Nevertheless, I'll give it my best shot. And then he goes on to talk about detention camps, concentration camps on American soil. And one of the things that's happening is that convicts, that people who are in penitentiaries, will become essentially slave labor for the American military. He then goes on to raise the issue of the use of private security organizations in Katrina to handle security and to put down all those horrible looters that the press told us were down in New Orleans pillaging those stores to try to get something to eat. And says he proposes the idea that we could end up seeing death squads in the United States. And he says, what? Death squads? People gone missing in the middle of the night here in America? Why, that's just absurd. Things like that can't happen here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. And he goes on and says, that is what you're thinking, isn't it? That is the thought that you always use to comfort yourself, as long as you can remain firm in your commitment to the idea that nothing truly bad can happen in the greatest nation on earth. Then you can continue to ignore all the evidence to the contrary.
Well, part of some of the evidence to the contrary is these very, very same private security organizations or companies or contractors that are being used by the U.S. military in Iraq. I think there's a figure of, it was something like 20,000 individuals employed by
who are being well paid.
15,000 to 20,000 individuals who are from the soldiers or the security contractors in Iraq who are being paid large sums of money to essentially act like the private armies or that McGowan talks about.
They're getting experience.
Well, we could be alarmist and say that they're cutting their teeth in Iraq, you know, because the fact is that if you look, there's some videos and there's a lot of evidence, written reports from Iraq about the activities of these contractors, and there's some video evidence as well of how they conduct themselves in Iraq. And there's one notable video, which is a collage of days in the lives of these security contractors, and they're driving along the streets of the roads of Iraq, of the various cities, and they have at least one or two guys watching out the back of their SUV as they're driving along, and if the guys decide that there's a car approaching them is in any way suspicious, or you know, if it's just getting too close to them, or if it's the only car on the road driving fast towards them, well, as cars kind of do, you know, they'll just open up, fire on it, and kill the occupants.
Without establishing.
No, beforehand. They just drive on. They don't even stop. They just slow down and they open up in the car behind and they just wait until it kind of rolls off the road and into the ditch and then they drive on. And they don't ask any questions and they don't care. And the thing is, people
would
say,
this is American democracy. This is the liberation.
Well, the important point is that people would tend to kind of try to dilute the horror of that a little bit by saying, and you know, admittedly in an almost racist kind of way, that these are American citizens. And that it's easier for them to do that to Iraqis because they're Iraqis, because they're not Americans, and that the chances of them doing that to American citizens are a lot less. For example, if they were employed at some stage in some social crisis in the US, that all you would have to do if you were confronted by one of them would be to say, you know, hey, I'm an American citizen just like you, you know, don't hit me with that stick, or don't shoot my friend, you know. But they would just, what people don't understand is that these people don't care. I mean, it's not about Iraqis or Americans when it comes down to it, because these people go to Iraq and they don't have any, they know that the people that they're killing in Iraq are ordinary citizens. They don't hate them. You know, the fact is, when you have someone like that who's able to just cold-bloodedly kill another human being, you can say that they're racist. There may be some racism, as in, you know, they may say to themselves, well, you know, damn ragheads or whatever. But that attitude, in a second, be turned around and turned into, you know, a damn liberal or a damn lefty or a damn commie or a damn socialist
or a damn Democrat or a damn Latino.
Anything. It can turn around in a second. And those guys do not care, because that's the type of human beings that they are. They just lack any kind of decency or any kind of
conscience.
Soul or conscience, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and they're interested in their enormous six-figure salaries.
Exactly, so. And they're going to do their job. And when they're sent out to patrol an area where they've been told there may be some trouble, well, then that's trouble, whether it's in the form of an Iraqi man or an American citizen or whatever. They are inherently racist, but in a very general sense, against anybody that they can deem to be an enemy. And, you know, anybody can be an enemy, and it's just who their employers tell them that the enemy is. So
they're well-programmed robots.
If they were ever on the streets of America in a kind of a conflict situation or social unrest situation, they would have no problem whatsoever in gunning down ordinary American citizens. And for anybody to think that would not be the case is a big mistake.
Again, lest anyone think that would never happen. I mean, it was Papa Bush who first used mercenaries in the first Gulf War, and now we have George Jr. using them quite extensively in Iraq in Gulf War II, and
bringing them home in Katrina, using them on the streets of New Orleans.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, do we see a progression here? Mm-hmm.
And this brings us into the last thing we wanted to kind of touch on this week, which is the recent demonstrations in France against the law that the de Villepin government tried to bring in. And as anyone who has seen the news would be aware, millions of French people took to the streets to contest this law. They did not take it lying down. They didn't roll over. They knew that they had to stand up and fight. And they did. And the government backed down.
Well, the fact is, there's, you know, that was aided by the fact that there's a long history of kind of social protest and social movements and people standing up for their rights in France that doesn't exist in America, for example. But it's interesting to note that over the period of time that these kind of there was some violence, some kind of, but really only sporadic and in small groups during the protests in France and in Paris, and the students in the universities had some altercations with the police, but it was pretty limited. Largely, it was peaceful, and there were, in fact, you know, on certain days there were several million people in the streets. As I said, the interesting thing is that in the press, in the American mainstream press, the way this was reported was that there was no focus on the justice or the justification for these protests. All of the focus was on the fact that, you know, the French government was having a problem because of its kind of socialist orientation or its social welfare system, and that they had essentially let it go too far, where essentially they couldn't even pass a law anymore without the people kind of rising up and imagine that. Yeah. Well, you know, the idea was that, you know, I mean, France was becoming ungovernable, you know, were, mm-hmm. were people. Government couldn't pass a law without, for example, if government tried to pass a law and some people took exception to it, that they could just stand up and say no. Now, this obviously doesn't seem right to when you're considering the American form of government, because obviously, you know, your government's there and your government is elected by the people and your government will always do the right thing, so there's never any need to protest what your government's doing in America.
And it's coupled with the neoliberal arguments that the French state is out of date, that it needs to be modernized to be able to catch up in this new global economy.
Yeah.
And, of course, what that means is that social services need to be cut and the money needs to be diverted to the corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what the French people are aware of.
Guns and mercenaries.
And they are refusing it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear the kind of whining going on in the Anglo-Saxon press about these French people and what they're doing to Europe, you know, a year ago they refused the neoliberal constitution, and now they're taking to the streets to refuse these absolutely necessary modernization measures that if they don't come in, then all of Europe is going to be relegated to the Dark Ages again.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas in Canada when it happened, in the UK when it happened, in the United States, everybody's accepted it, with, say, the exception of the British miners who fought like hell in the UK against Thatcher.
That argument is predicated on the idea that, you know, this would be a good thing.
Yes.
That it would be a good thing to open up the French economy to, you know, to global corporations and to globalization. But, you know, all we have to do is just repeat what we mentioned earlier on in our show about the fact that in America today, a result of this style of economy is that you have the CEO of major companies earning 2,000 times that of the average worker.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's obviously a gross injustice and a serious corruption.
And it's not any sort of a society that can be sustained. And at some point, it's going to have to explode. For more information, you can check out our website, www.signs-of-the-times.org.
And also, don't forget to visit www.qfgpublishing.com to check out two of our new books we've released, one of them on Falconelli by Patrick Riviere, and the other by Andrew Lobachevsky, entitled Political Ponerology, which is a study of evil adjusted for political purposes.
And if you want to understand why the situation is even worse than you can possibly imagine, you need to read Lobachevsky's book. It's about psychopaths in power. And believe me, the psychopaths are in power in every country on the globe. And they know that they're different than you and me, and they're working to shut us out completely.
Political Ponerology was written by Lobachevsky, who has firsthand experience of this pathocracy, as he calls it. So it's definitely a must-read.
And we'll leave it at that this week. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.